Hello, Broncos country. Welcome back to the DenverBroncos.com podcast. As a quick introductory note, the podcast is available on the site, obviously, but you can also subscribe to it on iTunes. Moving on, it's the last week of October, which means it's Sportsapalooza, with the NBA having started on the 28th. The World Series ended on Wednesday with a San Francisco Giants win, and the NHL rolled on in its first few weeks, and the NFL is still deeply entrenched in the middle of its regular season. As a Charlotte native and as someone who used to cover the Bobcats, I was excited to see the Hornets return, and especially in an exciting 24-point comeback against the Milwaukee Bucks. That game went to overtime, and though the Bucks were worst in the league last year, they've made some improvements, and hopefully the Hornets will continue to get better over that debut. Naturally, I'll be watching a bit of the Nuggets too, and they look to be building a fun young team. Anyway, back to the NFL. This is, after all, an exciting time in the middle of the season as divisions start shaping up. Let's get into a quick weekend update to check on what happened around the league. Ben Roethlisberger became the first player with two 500-yard games, completing 40 of 49 passes for 522 yards and 6 touchdowns. Also from that same game, it seems pretty amazing how the Colts go from shutting out the Bengals in the previous week and then give up 51 points to Pittsburgh. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that when a team puts on a complete defensive showing and then goes the exact opposite direction. And speaking of 51 points, the Broncos' upcoming opponent, the Patriots, dropped just that many on the Bears as well. On Monday night, Dallas dropped a close overtime game to their rivals in Washington as they turned to their third quarterback of the season in Colt McCoy. After injuring his back on a sack in the third quarter, Tony Romo missed all of the rest of regulation except for the final drive. Meanwhile, McCoy finished with a solid 299 yards on 25 for 30 passing in an upset over the NFC East leader. Now, there's a lot of close races, the AFC North, AFC South, NFC North, NFC East, and they're all looking to be pretty good races. However, the NFC South stands out as having a pretty terrible year. The Panthers lost to the Seahawks on Sunday, falling below 500 at 3-4-1, and yet they're still atop the division. When all the teams are playing this poorly, you just have to stay ahead of the rest of them, and right now that's not too difficult a task. Looking forward to the end of the season, you probably have to think someone's going to have to stand out and win some games, but that isn't showing right now. We've also got some stat updates here with the Broncos' perspective. With Dallas's loss, the Broncos move into the best record in the NFL, with Arizona right there with them, but that head-to-head win for Denver moves them ahead in the tiebreaker. Also, the defense has done incredibly well as of late, and it's showing up in the stats. They moved into the top spot on rushing yards per game allowed, and even when adjusting for per-rushing play numbers, they're still fifth. They're also at number two in passing yards per play allowed, and that number won't look very good in the per-game stats, but because the run defense closes the door on that option for opponents, those teams often turn to the air more often against the Broncos than when they play against other teams. Shifting our focus to the offense, the Broncos are number one in passing yards per play, points per game, and red zone percentage. So what this says is that they're efficient in the air, they're effective when they get close to scoring. And naturally, a big part of that has been Peyton Manning. Of course, if you look at the numbers, Manning has had some of the best performances of his 17 years just in the past two seasons with the Broncos. Maybe it's a bit of personnel, a bit of offensive play calling and philosophies. Our own David Deschamps wrote a great story over the weekend about it and found that a mix of all that and his health has helped him push towards new heights. I highly recommend checking that article out on DenverBroncos.com. And now, let's get to reviewing Thursday's game. It was a gorgeous setting for the Broncos and the Chargers on Thursday night. The weather was outstanding, there was a big matchup with strong implications in the divisional race in the AFC West. You really could not have asked for better conditions. San Diego entered the game coming off their first loss since week 1 against the NFC West leading Cardinals, and then they exited the game coming off their third loss of the season. It was a draw after the first quarter with each team punting after two drives apiece, but the Broncos had more ease in moving the chains on those drives, hinting that their offense could pick it up further. That they did, moving down the field thanks to the work of Manning and Emmanuel Sanders, who had 50 yards on that drive and capped it with a touchdown. The Chargers answered with a touchdown of their own on a 13-play, 84-yard drive, the kind that they take a lot of pride in that really chews up the clock. However, those kinds of drives were few and far between thanks to the rushing defense's effort that the Broncos defense has set their reputation on. With the inability to extend drives and an interception to start the second half, the Chargers fell behind as the Broncos offense kept rolling. Emmanuel Sanders had his breakthrough game with 3 touchdowns, and Ronnie Hillman again came up big, though it was Jawan Thompson who got the touchdowns on the ground, both on fullback dives near the goal line. San Diego couldn't get closer than within 2 touchdowns of the Broncos, and Denver walked away with a 14-point win, 35-21. And they also got control of the division after beating the second-place team. Columnist Andrew Mason joins me now to go over some of that game. Injuries, divisional rivalry, etc., etc. All things considered, how impressive did you find this victory?
Well, maybe not as comprehensive as the San Francisco game 4 days earlier, but certainly a pretty good statement against a team that had caused a lot of problems the previous year. I mean, look at the 3 games they played in the 2013 season. The collective difference between the two teams was 8 points. Being able to have a decisive win, maybe not to the degree of the 49er game, and certainly the Broncos did a good job exposing the Chargers at their weak point on the outside. I mean, you saw the Emmanuel Sanders 31-yard touchdown from Peyton Manning. You're going right at Richard Marshall, who's been kind of tortured by the Broncos the last couple of years and, in fact, was cut a few days after that game. And really, you know, so they found the weak point and they exposed it. But that's what good teams do. And just as significant as the quality of the win, it's another division win. You've now got two home division wins against the Chargers and Chiefs so far. So you're right where you want to be, 2 games ahead in the loss column, and at worst having a split against the top two rivals for the crown. So you can't be anything but impressed with where the Broncos are after that game and what they got out of it.
With only 61 yards on the ground allowed, this was the 4th straight game with fewer than 70 rushing yards allowed by the Broncos. Why does it seem like no one can run on them?
Well, it starts up front. It starts on the inside. Whether you've got Terrence Knight and working with Sylvester Williams or Marvin Austin there, or when teams run against the Broncos nickel, well, you've got Derek Wolfe and Malik Jackson often in there. You've always got at least one guy up front among those two defensive tackles that's going to occupy 2 blockers. So you've got one-on-ones elsewhere along the line. And what that also does is against the run in particular, when you've got every offensive lineman occupied by the front, that means your linebackers are free to make plays. And certainly we've seen, Brandon Marshall has become very comfortable working at weak side linebacker. Nate Irving, very good instincts, particularly against the run. You know, those are guys that fill the gaps that emerge after the front line has done its job. And the combination of that plus, anytime you see a stretch play, even if it's away from Von Miller, he's got a great chance to bring it down because of the sideline to sideline speed that he has. And with all that coming together, plus, I'm doing another plus here, you have aggressive cornerbacks who know how to play the run. Chris Harris and Aqib Talib are very good at stepping in there, making tackles, or at least if not making tackles, then setting up others to make. And Bradley Roby, when he's in the slot, and they run again, and they run when he's out there, same thing. So all that, I mean, you look at the Broncos' run defense, and you go 11 men deep, and it's really hard to find a weak spot. And because of that, there's just not going to be the lanes to run for other teams. That's why the big part of why the Broncos have had an elite run defense. And certainly as long as this unit is healthy, I don't see any reason why that's not going to continue. And if anything, maybe even get a little bit better because, as this unit continues to congeal and continues to grow, they're going to have an even more innate understanding of what they're all doing. So, as good as the run defense has been, and like I said, starts at defensive tackles and works outside, when you've got that many guys playing well and that many guys commit to defending the run, you're going to see results like this, which make an opponent one-dimensional.
Let's go back to Brandon Marshall just for a second here. On Thursday, we saw him play perhaps the best performance of his career. From what I saw, he was finding the gaps in the line, stopping the run, showing strong tackling, and even some solid pass coverage. Coach Fox said after the game that Marshall even got the game ball on defense. What did you see him do so well against San Diego?
Anticipation. and a lot of that goes to his preparation. He's able to react instinctively to what's happening because he's studied it and he knows how a play is developing. I touched on this in the Upon Further Review piece this week, where he blows up a screen pass to Oliver, and Oliver kind of flares out of the pocket and goes off into the left flat, and Marshall just reads it perfectly. Of course, again, it helps with good players around him. It helps when you have Von Miller making a play around the right edge, which closes off that side of the field. It helps when you've got a guy like Derek Wolfe drawing a double team. And, Marshall is kind of, and he helps when you got Nate Irving doing a good job covering Antonio Gates on a short drag route in the play. So Marshall is able to have his responsibilities confined to the running back coming out of the backfield. He reads the play, and he's there so fast that the blocker coming over doesn't even have time to do anything, make any kind of effective impact on the play. And Marshall just simply blows it up, and you've got a third down stop. And you saw plays like that all throughout the game from Brandon Marshall, where it seemed like he was one step ahead of the Chargers. And that really is just good preparation, studying your film, knowing tendencies, knowing what an opponent's going to do. And it's rare to see a player on defense read a Mike McCoy offense like that. You don't see that against the Chargers very often. Hats off to Brandon Marshall. I mean, he really keyed on some stuff on San Diego. He really knew what they were doing, and it shows you how he's maturing as a player. He's studying well. He's applying it, and really now, I mean, you look at the Broncos. In a few weeks, they're going to get Dane Trevathan back, but they keep Brandon Marshall healthy, and you can put Marshall and Trevathan out there together. I mean, they're going to be in great shape with the two of them.
Let's turn our attention to the offense now. No sacks, 139 total rushing yards. What grade do you give the offensive line?
I'm a tough grader, so I'm going to give a B+. they had a very good game. They had a very good game against a team that has to create its pass rush through tactical creativity. They have to, they don't really have any elite edge pass rushers. I mean, not Dwight Freeney at this point in his career. I wouldn't call him elite. So because of that, they've got to dial up pressure by disguising blitzes, making sure you don't know what their intent is. So credit to the offensive line for being able to generally read and diagnose what the Chargers were going to do. That was something the Broncos struggled at, particularly in the Thursday night game last year, that they really struggled to identify where pressure was coming from, and it led to some poor plays on the offensive side. So a good game, but again, the Chargers, struggling a little bit on defense, and they have some good players, but maybe not elite type players that you have to deal with in some other games. So that's why I only give a B+. Now, if they have that sort of performance, down the line, let's say by chance they play Arizona at some point in the future again, and they do better than they did back in the Week 5 game, then that's the kind of performance that I would give an A to.
I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but the Broncos are now second in passing yards per play allowed. Just how well is this secondary coming together?
Well, they know where each other is supposed to be now, and believe it or not, that was a problem earlier this year, particularly in the offseason and in the preseason. And that's just a natural byproduct of guys working, a group working together for the first time. I mean, Aqib Talib and Chris Harris, they'd worked together as freshmen at the University of Kansas. Raheem Moore and T.J. Ward knew each other, but they've never, played together. But, I mean, they go back to their high school days as far as being familiar with each other, but hadn't really played actively with each other. And then you had Bradley Roby coming in, and you had to figure out where he fit, and Aqib Talib had to figure out where other guys fit. So it takes time. That's, people tend to underestimate the importance of communication in the secondary, and that's why no matter how talented a group you've got, and this group is extremely talented, 1 through 5, no matter how talented a group you have, you're not going to have everything down pat in terms of guys knowing where they're supposed to be. Even if you say that's the case in May, it takes time because you have to get into games and actually get into full speed play and see how everyone reacts and where you want everyone positioned. So what you've seen the last few games is the maturation of that. And, you know, I've talked about the communication elsewhere on the defense. I've talked, you know, about guys coming together. That's, you know, that's what you're seeing now. You know, you're seven games in the schedule. You know, you've been able to keep this unit together. They've been able to stay healthy. And because of that, now they've got that the innate knowledge of, you know, where each other's going to be, what each other's role is. They're playing well off each other. And the other thing, I mentioned Bradley Roby briefly, being able to trust him and know that you know, he's going to play inside on the slot man and know that he's going to take care of his guy. You don't have to give him any more help than you'd give Talib or Chris Harrison in that kind of situation. That helps as well. You're not worried about, oh, is this rookie going to hold up? Is he going to handle his man? Or are we going to have to assist him? You know he's generally going to do his job, and that frees up everybody else to succeed as well.
With these two teams atop the division, this game could have a very big impact on the division's future in the coming months. San Diego was atop just two games ago, and now Denver has a 1.5-game lead over them. Now let's go to Warren Giudice and David Deschamps for the updated AFC West rundown following a big week. So we've covered the instrumental impact of the Broncos-Chargers game, but the rest of the division continued to shape up too. Kansas City won an easy one against the Rams, and the Raiders walked out of Cleveland still searching for their first win of the season. Lauren, it seemed like this could have been a winnable game for Oakland. Why did they yet again come up short?
Well, yep, they did come up short again, and I mean, it was a pretty close game throughout. Shockingly, while the Raiders' recent history hasn't been very bright, their 13-game losing streak is their second longest in franchise history, and they kept it close, especially in the first half. It was really a field goal battle. The Browns settled for field goals on three of their first four drives, despite getting the ball on the Oakland 48 after Matt Schaub threw a pick on the Raiders' first drive. But the Browns pulled ahead with two touchdowns in the fourth quarter, one on a 4-yard touchdown reception from Andre Hawkins, and then a Ben Tate 5-yard touchdown run. And then with 7 seconds left, the Raiders made it a little closer when Derek Carr connected with Andre Holmes for a 10-yard touchdown. And it started poorly for the Raiders. This is probably one of the low lights of the game on a fake field goal. Matt Schaub, in his first pass attempt of the year on 4th and 12, bobbled the snap and looked down the field to Michael Rivera, but it was picked off and returned for 35 yards. Offensively, you have to give the ball to Derek Carr. He finished the game for 328 yards and one touchdown, and that's a career high in passing yards for him, but recently defenses are really collapsing on the Raiders' passing attack, and they're only averaging just over 6 yards per passing attempt. And with that run game stifled, the Raiders are really being forced to plug away in the air on short passes, and you know, obviously it's really hard to make an impact and drive the ball downfield when your completions are so short. He did have a costly mistake in the fourth quarter. He fumbled the ball inside his own 10-yard line, and then two plays later, Ben Tate scored his touchdown. And the offense really, I mean, while the final score was 23-13, the offense really only scored 6 points, and they were only able to get into the end zone during garbage time. And shockingly, it's kind of hard to believe, but there's only been one time this season that the Raiders have surpassed 14 points. What really put the nail in the coffin for the Raiders was turnovers. They were a big problem for the Raiders in this game, and they had two in the fourth quarter when the game was still in reach. First, that Carr fumble, and then Darren McFadden fumbled the ball in Cleveland territory when the Raiders were only down by three, and the game was still very winnable at that time. And that was killer because the Browns took the ball downfield and increased the lead to 10, putting the win out of reach for the Raiders. And McFadden had 59 yards and 12 carries, but other than his acceptable performance, the Raiders couldn't get anything going on the ground and totaled just 71 yards rushing. And Rivera led the Raiders with 7 receptions, and the Raiders really need to utilize him more if they're going to make any progress offensively. In past weeks, we've put the burden on the defense and blaming them for losses because the offense has been producing, but this week couldn't really do that. You know, the Raiders' defense definitely took steps forward in this game, and this loss was not their fault, and the Browns were held to just 15 first downs in the game. And a big problem that the Raiders had gone through during their first six games was holding teams on third down. And the Browns were held to just 15 first downs in the game and were just 2 of 12 on third down conversions, and that's the lowest conversion rate of the season. The Raiders held the Browns to just 306 total yards, and that's their second lowest output of the season, and just 39 yards on the ground. And, I mean, the Browns are no chumps in the running game, and that was by far their lowest rushing total of the season. You know, and when your offense continues to turn the ball over and you can't create any, it's tough to win. And, you know, the defense kept the Browns out of the red zone until the fourth quarter, but just couldn't contain. They really fell apart on that drive following the McFadden fumble, and the Browns took the ball downfield with ease, and they only needed four plays and just over a minute for the 53-yard touchdown drive. And I mean, I think if you solely look at the Raiders' defensive stats after the game, you'd probably think that they would have won this game, but you know, they just couldn't put a full game together on both sides of the ball.
The past three games, the Raiders have lost by 3, by 11, by 10. It seems like they're getting closer to getting that first win. It looks like they're keeping a lot closer with these opponents. Does it look like they're going to get there soon?
I mean, they definitely have taken steps forward. They're getting better. There's no doubt about that. But I think this team just can't catch a break, and there's just sometimes teams just can't find ways to win. And I would say that the team is improving, but they just have such a tough schedule ahead of them that I'm not sure how soon they will get that first coveted win. And I mean, the thing that bothered me most about this game is that I really questioned their game plan. They continue to try and throw the ball against one of the worst run defenses in the NFL. And while their game plan is questionable, I think that their difficulty of schedule is just going to make it so difficult for them to find a win. You know, they've got the Seahawks next week in Seattle, then the Broncos and the Chargers and the Chiefs. And based on what I've seen, it looks like they may have a chance against the Rams and the Bills. But other than that, I mean, this schedule is brutal. And I think next week will definitely be interesting against the Seahawks. Obviously, the Seahawks aren't who they were last year, but I don't think the Raiders have improved quite that much. But I do think it'll be an interesting game. You know, in the preseason, Derek Carr really, you know, he's shown that he's not afraid to throw against tough corners and tough secondaries. And, you know, he threw three touchdown passes against Seattle in the preseason finale. Some of them were good, deep passes against, you know, the Seattle starters. So I think it'll be a tough test, and I'm not sure when the Raiders will get that first win, but you know, I think a lot of that has to do with their strength of schedule.
Thanks, Warren. It's certainly a tough schedule from here on out. If there's a date to circle on your calendar as a Raiders fan, it's got to be November 30th when they face St. Louis. Prospects for the Chiefs, however, are looking up. They've made up ground in the divisional race and are now just a half game behind the Chargers at 4-3 after taking down the Rams with ease. David, did you see any speed bumps for Kansas City in this one?
I don't know if I would say speed bumps, maybe a hiccup here or there. It was really a pretty complete victory, but it didn't start out that way. The Rams went right down the field for a touchdown on the game's first possession. They got a big play from Kenny Britt. They went up 7-0, but that was the last time that they scored. So from there, it was a pretty dominant performance by Kansas City. They had one other hiccup. They fumbled a handoff between Alex Smith and Jamaal Charles deep in their own territory. They lost it, but their defense responded by sacking Austin Davis for a 12-yard loss, missed field goal by Greg Zuerlein, and it didn't matter. So otherwise, they were very, very complete in this game. What we've seen from them on offense is kind of a steady ball control offense, just continuing to pick up yardage. Not a ton of big plays, but that's kind of what we've seen from Andy Reid offenses in the past, and that's how they've been this year. They had four drives with 10 or more plays. They held the ball for 35 minutes. That's, you know, pretty much what we've seen from them this year. Alex Smith was super efficient, 24 of 28, great numbers. Didn't really go deep, but he didn't have to. They just kept moving the ball. The run game was clicking. Jamaal Charles had a solid day. Nile Davis also got in, actually had more carries than Charles. Had a solid day as well, and had a kick return for a touchdown. So on offense, they were just very steady, like they've been most of the year. Defense really gave the Rams offense fits. They sacked Austin Davis 7 times. Justin Houston had 3 of those. He now has 10, which is the most in the NFL. He's ahead of Von Miller by 1, so it'll be a fun race to watch the rest of the year. But Chiefs defense certainly looked to have a hold of this game. They allowed only 200 yards total. They've really limited teams through the air. So overall, a complete victory on both sides of the ball and special teams with the return touchdown.
The way Kansas City has played recently, you know, they've taken down San Diego and they've played a lot better than they started the season. Do you see them as a bigger threat than San Diego right now after San Diego's lost a couple in a row here?
You know, maybe. It's interesting. After week one, when they got stomped by the Titans, Chiefs didn't look like a very good football team, but every week it looks like more and more of an aberration. They played the Broncos very close. They stomped the Patriots. They played the 49ers very close. They beat the Chargers in San Diego. This is a pretty good football team. Football Outsiders uses DVOA to measure teams' efficiency on both sides of the ball. The Chiefs are the fourth best team in the NFL by DVOA, whereas the Chargers are ninth. The Broncos are first. So that's kind of where all those rankings fall. Certainly feels like the Chiefs are a better team than a 4-3 team, especially considering their schedule. And they have a bit of an easier schedule going forward. They have to play the Seahawks, but they get them at home in Arrowhead. They have to play, you know, the Broncos and Chargers again, obviously, but they get both of those at home. They still get the Raiders twice. They get the Jets this weekend at home. So we could see a team that racks up some wins. Obviously, they played the Broncos closer than the Chargers did with that tough Week 2 victory. You know, it came down to a fourth down stop near the goal line. So it will be interesting to see if the Chiefs continue on this trend. They don't seem like the more explosive team, but they seem very steady. And the defense is really picking it up, especially with two strong pass rushers. This really makes the Week 13 game on Sunday night, which will be in Arrowhead when the Broncos go to Kansas City, very important. I mean, if the Chiefs can rack up some wins between now and then, we could be talking about a very, very important game on that Sunday.
The Chargers took home some pretty easy wins, Jaguars, Raiders, Jets. So looking back at their schedule, a lot of those wins don't really seem as strong right now after dropping the last two. It'll be interesting to see how things shape up for the Chiefs. They're on a bit of a roll. They're getting themselves into good shape right now as the Chargers seem to be trending downward. Thanks for joining me, David and Warren. Right now, we'll go back to the Broncos and preview their game on Sunday against the Patriots. With the big divisional test behind them, the Broncos now face a big conference test in facing one of the best teams in the AFC and in the league as a whole. Of course, I'm talking about the Patriots. Seems like a yearly thing to discuss the Patriots as one of the conference and league's best teams. And this is the 16th matchup between Peyton Manning and Tom Brady, and yet again, they're leading two of the best teams in the league. It's always a ballyhooed matchup, and this should be no exception. The Patriots have put their slow start way, way behind them. I don't know if you remember all that sports talk show chatter about whether Brady was in a huge decline and all that, but in the four games since, he's had passer ratings of 111, 140, 104, and 148. No interceptions, 14 touchdowns. I dare say that Brady burial was a bit too soon. The Patriots have won all of those last four games, by the way, Cincinnati, Buffalo, New York Jets, the Chicago Bears, all wins. But this game against the Broncos could be the toughest one yet. And this is a two-way street, don't get me wrong. This could also be the Broncos' toughest game yet. Mace, a month ago, the Patriots got annihilated by the Chiefs. Frankly, that seems like a bit of a turning point right now in their season so far. Patriots head coach Bill Belichick talked about that in his media availability on Wednesday.
You know, Kansas City really played very well in that game. We weren't able to do much. Other games, we've been able to do more in all three phases of the game in the last 4 weeks. So I don't think it's any one thing. They're all different teams. They're all different matchups. We'll just try to do the best we can this week to, you know, have a good game plan, a good week of preparation, and be able to go out there and play and coach well Sunday against the Broncos. And that's really what this game's about is, you know, what happens this week, not what happened, you know, some other week or some other game or whatever. It's just about this, what's in front of us between now and Sunday.
After week four, we talked about the Patriots, and you pinpointed a bunch of their issues that game, having to deal with their offensive line woes. How much have they improved in that regard?
The improvement's been drastic, and particularly at the tackles. You know, Nate Solder, a guy that I know a lot of our listeners are familiar with from University of Colorado, was just awful in the first month, and he's really improved in the last four games. Sebastian Vollmer on the other side, he's playing much better ball, and maybe even I would argue the best ball of his career to this point in the last few games. So, you know, everything flows from the two tackles, and you know, if you look back at the Bronco-Patriot game last year, you know, when when Brady in the passing game for the Patriots got into trouble, it was when the tackles were beaten. I mean, you had Von Miller with a big play. You had pass rushes coming from the outside and disrupting the Patriots in the first half, and you know, also disrupting the run game as well. I mean, you had the edges that were closing really fast on their running backs, and they weren't able to make plays. So the Patriots are going to go as far as their offensive tackles allow them to go, because if they can, you know, they buy enough time for Tom Brady, then what that does in turn, it gives the receivers the chance to make that one extra break and for Brady to get the ball downfield to them and rely more on the plays between the numbers down the field rather than deep on the outside, which is something that Brady doesn't do quite as well as he used to back in his younger days.
Last week, we talked about the difficulty in containing a tight end like Antonio Gates. But this week, Broncos face another top tight end in Rob Gronkowski. How much should his talents concern the defense this week?
Considerably, because we've talked on previous podcasts about how the Broncos have had trouble covering tight ends. And then, lo and behold, let's go to the Charger game last week, and Antonio Gates has a couple of touchdowns, and he makes that big play on third and long where he's up against Quentin Carter, and he makes the move short, and Carter bites on it, which is really something surprising because of the fact that in third and long, you're basically saying, okay, play for the sticks, play for the line to gain. Don't worry about the short stuff. So, you know, that's a little bit of a concern. You do wonder how they're going to defend Gronkowski. Is it going to be another safety? You know, Quentin Carter, who we just mentioned, has missed a couple of days of practice this week with a hamstring problem. So, you know, if it's another safety, that ends up being a guy like David Bruton, who hasn't seen much time on defense so far this year and has been and battled injuries earlier in the season. Is it a cornerback? You know, Aqib Talib obviously knows Gronkowski well from their time in New England together, but the problem is Rob Gronkowski is 265 pounds. So if you put a cornerback on him, you're creating a size mismatch. Is it a linebacker? You know, we talked about Brandon Marshall earlier in the podcast. Maybe, you know, with his improvement in coverage, maybe you put him on Gronkowski and see what happens. But again, we talked about the power disadvantage that a cornerback would have, and then a linebacker like Marshall would have a speed disadvantage against Gronkowski. Just a lot of he causes a lot of problems. I think ultimately the solution is going to have to be some combination of all of these things, and maybe just kind of, you know, rotating who's on Gronkowski to say, okay, maybe you can't physically match up with Gronkowski, but maybe you can kind of confuse him and show some different looks to Tom Brady that force him to look elsewhere. But if you go man for man on him with the same thing, play after play, one way or another, whether it's speed or power, it's going to be a matchup disadvantage. And that's why Rob Gronkowski is so dangerous and so tough to cover.
Now, earlier this week, Brady was asked about whether he'd prefer the Patriots' weapons or Manning's weapons, because this is Brady Manning Bowl 2014. So, of course, all these questions between the two are going to come up. Naturally, he said that he'd pick the Patriots' weapons, because what else is he going to say, right? Now, if you had your pick, which one would you choose?
It's hard to argue against two Pro Bowl wide receivers in Wes Welker and Demaryius Thomas and a Pro Bowl tight end in Julius Thomas. I mean, that's tough to counter. So, yes, the Broncos have better weapons, but that being said, Brady, you know, like the great quarterback that he is finding ways to use his guys to their optimal effectiveness. Obviously, you know, Gronkowski is a matchup problem, but you know, they're getting better play out of Brandon LaFell, a free agent they signed from Carolina in the offseason. He's got a 56-yard touchdown on his resume. He's making some bigger plays downfield. Julian Edelman, you know, is making some plays underneath. You know, maybe he's not a slot machine, Wes Welker in Welker's prime, but you know, Edelman's still on pace for 90 receptions. What you like, you know, they'd like to get him the ball more in the red zone, get him into the end zone, but you know, he's having solid play. And then, you know, their running backs, I mean, they're not afraid to get them the ball out of the backfield. Shane Vereen in particular is a solid threat to, you know, coming into the flat, you know, a solid threat on screen passes, making plays in some space. So, I mean, they're not a sexy collection of targets, to be sure, but they're certainly effective in the last few weeks. I mean, you don't put up 158 points in the last four games without having something going for you. And yeah, you can nitpick at the collection of opponents that they had in that span, but when you're averaging just a shade under 40 points a game against for a month-long stretch, no matter who you're playing, that means you're doing something right. It's going to be a big test for them, and maybe their targets don't have the overall athleticism and physicality, aside from Gronkowski, that the Broncos have. But in that offense and with that quarterback, they're effective.
With an offense that's put up 51 points in the last game, they're looking to be clicking on that side of the ball. But you shouldn't overlook their defense as well. Which side do you think is going to be more difficult for the Broncos to deal with, the Patriots' offense or the Patriots' defense?
Well, you have to go with the offense because their defense, it's not quite the same without Gerard Mayo out there. I mean, the guy, the ringleader of that defense, the guy who really makes things go. Now, that being said, you're concerned about the Patriots' secondary. You know, Darrell Revis and also Brandon Browner, who's now playing, and certainly Browner has the size to maybe be used on Demaryius Thomas, so that would free up Revis to go up against Emmanuel Sanders and maybe even Wes Welker from time to time. You know, in spite of that, if the Patriots are going to win this game, it's going to be by finding a way to put up a 30 or a 40 spot like they have throughout the last month or so. So in that case, you know, the offense has to be the greater concern because the Patriots do want this to go into shootout mode. And, you know, certainly the Broncos are more than happy to play a shootout. But if the winds are whipping down from the north as they were last year coming through that open end at Gillette Stadium and causing problems for the offense, then it could create a game like last year where the Broncos passing game fails to gain consistent traction. And in that game, you know, the running game had to bail the offense out. So I think the Patriots' offense is still more of a concern because its ceiling is higher and it can do more to force the tempo of the game and to force the Broncos out of a effective, balanced offense more than the Patriots' defense can.
If you had to pick one key for the Broncos to come out on top in this game, what is that decisive factor?
One key. That's tough, actually, to focus in on one thing. But I'm going to go with protecting the football. You look back at the game they played in New England last November. You know, New England did not protect the football early, and the Broncos went up by 24 points. And then Denver did a poor job of protecting the football in the second half, and the Patriots came back, and you had a 31-31 tie going into overtime. And then in overtime, you had the mangled punt that bounced off Tony Carter's leg, and the Patriots recovered, and game over. You know, they won it on a field goal. So turnovers were the most damaging thing for the Broncos last year. If they could have avoided them, they would have won the game and probably won it quite comfortably. So you don't want to fumble the ball going for an extra 2 or 3 yards. You know, just focus on protecting the football. And if you don't get those extra yards, oh well, you move on to the next play, or you move on to the punt or whatever happens. But it was on the giveaways where the Broncos really, you know, gave the Patriots a window to come back. And so, you know, if you can get through this game, even on the turnover margin and or maybe even on the positive side, then the chances of winning are going to be excellent for the Broncos.
Belichick talked to the Denver media on Wednesday morning, and we got a taste of what he had to say about Manning and the secondary and more about this game coming up.
Yeah, I mean, right now we're just, you know, treating this game as obviously the most important game on our schedule because it's the next one. It's the one that we're in the middle of preparations for, and we have great respect for the Denver Broncos, their football team, Coach Fox, his staff, the players. They're obviously playing, you know, very well right now, playing great football, so that's really where my focus is. I'm working on. I think Harris had a real solid year. It looks like he's definitely back from the injury. Obviously being used a little bit differently this year, but you know he's been very effective. He's got good quickness. He's smart. Looks like he has a good feel and instinctiveness for route combinations. Good awareness. You know he's been productive around the ball. You know tackles well.
When you're at the top of the league and your schedule is as tough as the Broncos is, pretty much every game has the potential to be an exciting matchup, but this one should be one of the best we've seen thus far with the way each team is playing. The game is at 2:25 Mountain Time on CBS. We'll be heading out to Massachusetts to cover that game, and it'll be an exciting time. The weather is expected to be a bit windy and somewhere in the low 40s to upper 30s. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today. Don't forget you can subscribe on iTunes. Next week will be midway through the season, so get ready for midseason team awards and more in a progress report. Enjoy the game and have a nice weekend.